This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hi, I'm Kim. I'm the other half of Ravenous Couple.
Hi, I'm Hong, and actually, she's the better half of the Ravenous Couple.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you both for coming on. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
You know, that's a difficult question for me, but I just know that I love the culture. I embrace the culture. As a matter of fact, I'm still learning from the culture as well, too, even though I'm 100% Vietnamese. But just being Vietnamese, I'm very proud. I'm, you know, very like aware of the community, the culture, and I just embrace everything about being Vietnamese, from the food, the culture, to the language and all that.
I've been thinking about that question. Yeah. And honestly, I don't know. Language, in terms of language, I'm not really good at it. So
yeah,
in terms of language,
that's not good.
You know, maybe food is probably a big part of it for me. Is like, you know, sharing a similar set of food. But then I realized, you know, the more we learn about food, the more different people, Vietnamese people eat, even within the same community. So it's really, obviously, you know, maybe it's something that we share a same, place of origin, a similar history. So to me, I think about those things when I think, you know, what is to be Vietnamese, and those are the things that I try to share with my kids, because now they're asking me, you know, Dad, you know, where are you from? Where's your family from? So, you know, I do think about those things now that I'm more now that we have kids, you know, and so it's still, I think, a evolving thing and something that will continue to grow and maybe add to in the future what it means to be Vietnamese to us. So it's not one question, one answer, I guess.
Yeah, it's an ever-evolving answer, and we'll see, you know, next year, the year after, things will change too, because we constantly pick up new ideas and new facts about who we are, and I think culture evolves no matter if you're from you know, the United States or from France or Ukraine. You know, we're all changing. So how did you two meet?
We met through mutual friends. I went to Michigan. I'm actually from Orange County, and then Hong is from the Midwest. So I went to grad school in Michigan, and so did Hong.
Yeah. So I grew up in Michigan and went to school at the University of Michigan. Go Blue, right?
Yes, go Blue.
We were several years apart. So initially we only knew each other through the internet, right? Emails, phone calls. Mm-hmm. And then we finally met actually after like maybe a year of chatting, you know, so this is, you know, this is back when the internet was really young, right? Like Facebook was really young, Asian Avenue and things like that.
Over like 15 years. Yeah.
So, so yeah, we initially chatted and emailed and that's, but the connection was at the University of Michigan and That's where we met.
So both of you went to University of Michigan, and what did you both study?
I went to a dental school for grad school, so I'm a dentist.
Right. So I also went to undergraduate there. I actually studied history there, but then went to medical school there.
So wait, you studied history undergrad?
Yeah.
And with any emphasis in bio or pre-med?
No. I actually, my emphasis was actually in Southeast Asian history. And actually, that's where I sort of like had my Vietnamese culture, sort of Vietnamese American identity awakening too, because, you know, they had a great course on the history of Vietnam War. And, you know, then I took that course, and then, you know, they actually had a Vietnamese language course. And so, you know, growing up in Detroit, Michigan, or outside Detroit, Michigan, you know, I was probably the only Vietnamese in my school. And so that was where I sort of, embraced my Vietnamese American identity there, and studied history. Yeah. And I took, of course, the prerequisites, you know, but I didn't really care about being a bio major or anything.
You know, I talk about a liberal arts education on this program quite a bit. And I am always fascinated when I see the results of sort of some liberal arts class, like a Southeast Asian study. And I, when I study your page or your work and the history and the things that you talk about, what I see or confused about is, and I know that the background that both of you are in the medical field, and it struck me as a very confusing thing for me. I was always like, how are these two medical people showcasing such beautiful art with this history of the food and the lineage? And now it makes sense that you have this, you know, this very strong undergraduate training in history. It has a lot to do with, you know, the curiosity that you show on the page. And I'm not saying that medical people or people in the medical field are not or devoid of this sort of angle or perception, but I'm saying oftentimes it comes from this other place of curiosity and learning.
I think that actually is our angle. You know, if you were to ask us, you know, what's your angle? You know, what's
we
your
kind of like avoid that.
What's your angle? it is about you know, like you said in our tagline, preserving culture and history, or learning about culture and our history through food. Mm-hmm. You know, and that really is our angle in a nutshell. And I guess that's where the history part comes from me, because mm-hmm. I do think that, you know, our past really is guides our future and how we see things, and, you know, and our past certainly, you know, the more we study our past, the more we realize why things are they are today. You know, again, this is whether it's the lens of food or the lens of, you know, wherever, politics, or the lens of or you know, like where we are today in America as a Vietnamese community. You know, the more we study our past, the more we understand what, you know, why we are here today. And so, yeah, I think that's, you know, a really important part.
When you both, I have to ask this question because of the Michigan and the Midwest question that or answer that you answered. What's the difference between the food out there, the Vietnamese food, and the Vietnamese food out west here in California, and then the Vietnamese food around the world and even in Vietnam? Do you have an opinion on that? And this for both of you, would love to hear.
I think now it's spreading a little bit more now that, you know, with the supply, Michigan and the Midwest and other states, they're able to get more supply.
Well, Kim grew up, let me interrupt. Kim grew up in Little Saigon, like Bosa. She's like OG Bosa, you know, Westminster, you know. So
I was used to more of like the supply.
She's been there with like, you know, 79 her whole life.
Yeah. And, you know. I would say it's, you know, Little Saigon, you have more options. There's like a lot more, you know, variety options, specialties, and so forth. I think when you go to like other states, they'll have one Vietnamese restaurant, but then they'll try to serve everything. There is that Vietnamese. In Little Saigon, Houston area, where there's more of a bigger Vietnamese community, you have shops that, you know, can specialize in just hủ tiếu or mì, or you have much more of a selection. But I would say years back when I went to school, they would even combine like Vietnamese restaurants with like Laos restaurants, just any, you know, just an Asian restaurant. But now it's starting to like branch out. There's more of it. But I would say now that there's more of the supply, they're able to get more of the supply. It could be pretty much similar.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, right? Like I said, Michigan. And, you know, back then was, you know, there's no Asian American, there's no grocery store that specialized in Asian American products. And you know, my mom and, you know, whenever we had to make something, we really always had to improvise. Mm-hmm. You know, when we made, when she made the ho'u, when she tried to make tofu, because there was really no good tofu out there. She had to build her own press, tofu press and things like that. Build their own bangun pot, you know, like they would just improvise, you know, they're really, you know, I think that's also another key thing that we think about when we think about Vietnamese food, is that we're very good enterprising people, you know, and
make
so
it work somehow.
Yeah, they made it work. They still, even in the early 80s, in the Michigan, we still ate Vietnamese food like every day, three meals a day growing up, you know, and so it was pretty amazing.
Say it again, kid.
I was used to just buying it, like I craved it, but when you go to like other states, you gotta figure out how to make it. And that's one of the reasons why we, you know, started the blog, because it was during a time when, you know, I was, you know, in college and like there in Riverside, and there wasn't a lot of you know, Vietnamese restaurants around. So if I craved Vietnamese food, I had to figure out how to make it. And that's when I learned how to start cooking. It's because, you know, I wasn't surrounded where I can just go and buy it.
So then again, when we met and we were talking long distance and email, like I was in postgraduate and she was graduate, and we were communicating back and forth from either Michigan, or she was in Arizona and I was in California and in Seattle. We would actually talk about what we like, what we'd like to eat. And so when we, when we get together, we would make meals at home, or, you know, at our apartments. And we would, at that time, again, we were very new, just like everyone. We didn't know how to cook, you know. Mm-hmm. And we would call our parents, or she would call her mom or aunt. But we would call them and have them on the phone and guide us as we cook, you know. And, you know, after like several times of this, you know, I was like, oh, we need to write this thing down, you know.
Forget.
And, you know, when they guide us, they, you know, they're not very accurate either. They're like, you know, một chút này, một chút kia, you know. And so it was very frustrating, right? And so we just sort of learned on the go, and we try to dribble notes down, but then we'll lose it or whatever. And you know, when you don't cook frequently, it's easy to forget.
Yeah.
And we don't have the muscle memory. We don't have the instinctual the instinctual cooking that our parents and our previous generation have from cooking daily, you know? And so that's really the impetus for starting that blog, because at that time, you know, blogs were really new too. And we're like, you know, we need to put this down for ourselves. And really that was it. We didn't think about it as like, oh, documenting it for other people. It was really more for ourselves. And maybe, if we ever had kids, you know, maybe, you know, but we really didn't think that far ahead, you know, but we were just like, this is just for ourselves so that we don't have to bug our parents every time and call them and for how much to put nuk mam in and things like that. And so that's how we started the blog and started documenting, some of these recipes.
It's amazing how things start sometimes when you hear the origin stories of these blogs or these channels. It's mind-blowing. You know, it starts with a simple necessity that you wanted to record the recipes. And so did you name it Ravenous Couple right off the bat?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just had a few discussions and think of, we really had very short brainstorming. And again, we didn't have any idea.
Yeah, we didn't
We didn't
have
have any
any
idea
plans
what we were
or anything
doing.
like
You
that.
know, we don't have any IT background or anything like that. We're just going by the seat of our pants. We just, what does that sound like to you? Does that
What
sound
did you
good? I mean,
think?
I don't know. At first, we were worried that, you know, maybe it has some lascivious
Yeah, like,
connotation, you know,
yeah.
like maybe some people looking for, like, you know, groupies or something. I don't know, but I don't think that ever happened. We never, you know,
Yeah.
that never happened. And we just, you know, we just made it about the food we liked and recipes that we, home style recipes that we were always asking our parents of. That's why, you know, we never really, for a long time, we never touched pho, and we never touched banh mi, and we never touched some of the more common things, because, like, almost, you know, you can find that really easily, you know. And so that's why we touched on a lot of like the homestyle stuff that we missed, like how to make pickled yeoguyo and how to make, you know, seonrang and you know, and tikka and things like that. Those are the recipes that we thought were harder to find, and those are the ones that we kept on asking our parents for, you know, that we missed when we were away.
When I look at the images on the food, this is the very current stuff.
Yeah.
When we go back to the beginning of your IG account, is there content before that that sort of bleeds in from the blog or wherever the blog left off? I mean,
Yeah.
is there an
So,
evolution to where we are today?
yeah. You know, like, again, a lot of you know, when we started the blog to now, the blog is sort of like semi-retired. Occasionally, we still may post it, but it's very once in a blue moon. You know, a lot of times, you know, people start a blog or start an IG account or a TikTok account, and if they have big aspirations to, you know, write a book or have a TV show or, you know, or even, you know, just make it a career, you can definitely do that in this day and age. You know, but back then, we never had that aspiration. We always wanted it just to keep it fun, and we, you know, we have separate careers already, and when the kids came, we sort of like got way too busy for that,
Yeah.
and that's when we transitioned to Instagram.
Yeah. And then we started like including them in like our stories and so forth and make it like, you know, family friendly
So that's
sometimes
where
too.
it transitioned. We
Yeah, so it
transitioned
evolved in
from
that
the
way.
blog to Instagram when the kids came.
Yeah.
Instagram is much easier to
Navigate and
to post
yeah.
quickly and get your information out there quickly, whereas a blog
You have
post,
to
as you
sit
know, you
down
sit
and
down, you write, you edit,
yeah,
you
it takes a
rewrite,
lot
you
of
re-edit.
time. Yeah.
So it takes much more time.
Yeah. So we praise people that are able to, you know, keep that up. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when you first started the blog and you were basically documenting your own journey in cooking and making the food, and later, I mean, in the most current iteration, it seems like I'm not sure where the line of you all making the food versus you all going out to eat and shooting pictures is. That, like, how does the content sort of, like, is constructed?
I would say 75% more we make most of the food, you know, and we do go out. So we do, you know, whenever we do go out, whether it's like a, you know, like a mom and pop shop or like somewhere, you know, fancy or like a destination place, then we'll, you know, showcase it. But mostly, majority of it is mostly home cooking.
It's definitely home cooking recipes is the blog, and you know, IG, we tend to just, you know, support restaurants that you know, supporting restaurants in general is something we like to do,
Yeah.
and, you know, business Vietnamese owners
Yeah.
especially.
And that actually, like during COVID, that was we evolved more in like supporting like Vietnamese businesses and our small businesses. So that was like a lot more during COVID.
At what point in the IG journey, the Instagram journey, did you say to yourself, "Oh my God, shit just got real"? Like, you know, people
To
were
answer
like,
you,
"Say again?"
we were still really small, you know.
Yeah.
To answer you, we're still really small. There's definitely a lot more Vietnamese Instagrammers or Vietnamese TikTokers that are, you know, huge, have a huge following. So I think that's partly because either we transitioned pretty late, but it's also, you know, I don't know. We're not really good at you know, there are some people that are really good at tagging and doing all these additional things that drive traffic to you. I don't know. We just post
and just let it ride.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so.
Yeah, and I can see that, and I can feel that, but I also feel like you guys are socially conscious, and you guys show up to the events that we don't see often food people showing up to. You know, there's things that are
definitely for sure. There's been a you know, in the past, if you look at our timeline or you look in the past, you know, we always had a sense, like you said, like some background of history and culture, but we didn't pass over into that social activism part until maybe, you know, maybe the Rodney Floyd, you know, I mean, George Floyd, and the Black Lives Matter situation. And, you know, I think that definitely had a little awakening in our account and how we use our account. And also COVID as well. You know, we used it more for like promoting, you know, businesses and Vietnamese, you know, and then, you know, the Asian violence, you know, things like that too. You know, ever since those things, we were more awakened
and aware. So it wasn't that we have all to use our food.
Platform.
Oh, this is interesting. Now, I didn't realize that George Floyd.
Yeah, actually, we had a bunch of fundraisers. You know, we actually had food events where we would actually fundraise for different causes. Mm-hmm. And so we had several of those before COVID, at least three or four or five of those before COVID. Yeah.
Did the community ever step out and say, look, you guys are in the food space, stay in the food space? Did you ever get any pushback for George Floyd or anything like that?
We had occasional comments here and there. We get those occasional comments on Instagram saying we're communists and things like that, you know. So you know, that's inevitable, right? It's in the internet, and you know, people say whatever. But nothing major, you know.
Because our community is very it's very polarized. You know, you're either I feel like you're either with the BLM movement or you're against it. You know, and a majority are actually against the BLM, you know, Black Lives Matter. The majority of the older generation will refuse to acknowledge the history that we have, or in America with the black power movement. And it's a thing that's very polarizing. So when, you know, when I think about somebody in the food space stepping up and saying, you know, we're now awaken to another way of looking at things, I feel like there could have been a potential pushback, but it didn't sound like you didn't have that.
Yeah, nothing major, just silly comments here and there.
Yeah, because Kim was like, no. Kim, you're like,
or block them before she even knows.
Oh, what? Say that again.
I would block them, or do, you know, I would you know, moderate them before she would know.
I would get so, like, you know, I think I would probably get a little hurt and be like, why would they say something like that? So he probably deleted it before I saw it.
Oh, wow. Protecting your wife from that stuff. Yeah. So how do you both divide the work, the day-to-day of the blog or the Instagram account?
We actually don't have a plan. It's like whoever gets home from work first starts cooking.
Again, we're not professional. Like, it doesn't, our livelihoods and income doesn't depend on it. Yeah. So we only do things if we're already doing it already.
Yeah.
So if we're already doing Ban Kun or Ban Mi, then that's when we do it. We don't plan any of it.
A lot of it isn't planned. A lot of it is like what, you know, we get on sale at the market, or if someone supplies us with something, they, like, you know, like our neighbor, she like wants to give us like 10 pounds of bean sprouts, and we're like, okay, then this weekend we'll go ahead and make so-and-so. A lot of it is sort of on plan, but kind of plan depending on what we have. So we don't have like an Excel spreadsheet, like
It's only and you know, for example, like I usually do most of the photos. Kim does most of the traditional cooking for pho and bunryu and all that stuff.
But I have nothing to do with the pizza.
Yeah,
the bread.
Exactly. Yeah, I will do the pizza and bread. I'll do more of the traditional stuff. Yeah, I usually do some of the more non-traditional stuff. Yeah. Like if you see anything like Peruvian or Italian or anything like that, then that's usually me. Mm-hmm. Bread and pizzas are me. Anything crazy like a dry aged salami.
Yeah, that's Hong Kong.
That's me too.
No wonder, because I was looking at that stuff. I'm like, that's not preserving Vietnamese culture, but I'm like, there's got to be.
So we're definitely not exclusive about that.
What we like,
are. Exactly, what our interests are, and you know. So.
But I do have to say that the pictures, there's some lighting involved. I mean, like there's some really careful lighting. There's tweezer actions. Like I feel like there's like placement. There's like it's really thought out. It's not random that you just we're gonna cook something today and then we're gonna take pictures. That's not happening.
There's never tweezers. Not when you have two kids. Yeah. There's never tweezers. Maybe we use the chopstick here and there, but.
But
I think it's just experience. To be honest, we've been doing this so long. To be honest, we started the vlog in 2008. We've been doing it so long that it's just memory. We just have an eye for it, I guess, too, you can say. I mean, and I don't want to like pat ourselves on the back or anything, but but it just comes because right now, like I said, we get food on the table. And we literally in the past, I have to admit, like we would sometimes, you know, labor like 10 minutes or and take like 30 different pictures, but that didn't last very long. You know, we knew when you have hungry kids and things like that, we really had to cut it down to like one or two pictures and 20 seconds, you know, of photography and styling. And that's literally what it is now. You
and
know?
There's no like professional lighting. Everything is.
It's just daylight, just natural lighting.
And the table that we're actually doing this Zoom meeting on. Yeah. So
And you shoot on the iPhone or do you have a DSLR?
Pure iPhone. Pure iPhone.
I don't even know where the battery of the camera is. So.
I think in the past we did do DSLR. Yeah. But now it's just
But then you would have to upload and now it's like iPhone just makes it so much easier.
It's a turnkey operation.
Yeah.
So how do you now think about the image of the food? Is there much thought or is it just basically what you have described?
There's some thought to it.
Some thought, but mostly it's instinctual, like you said. Yeah. Like it's I guess we have you develop a style over time, right?
Yeah.
So like you said, like if you look at our pictures, there's a certain style of how it looks.
And the plating, how we play. You know? But then it doesn't take, you know, long.
Yeah, it doesn't take long. Yeah. Like I said, you know, our Instagram is not our livelihood and it's not our career. And so we don't treat it like that. And so we really just treat it as a hobby. Yeah. And so it doesn't take away. We enjoy doing it, but it shouldn't take away from our lives either. Mm-hmm. And so it enhances, right?
Instead of and we still want to make it fun and, you know, get the kids involved as well too. So it makes it fun.
So it sounds like there's been this journey of just sort of doing what you feel is the right thing to do. And you continue to do that without much intentionality on it being a business or any sort of like there's a through line to make money or anything. But that being said, do you feel like things are developing and you could take it in a direction potentially to make more of an impact?
In the past, we did have offers for cookbooks and things like that. We did have offers and we've even had offers sometimes to be on different shows or different events. But we, in general, we've turned them down. We think it probably might affect our family life and things like that. And so we haven't pursued it. It's not one of our outs that we ever considered, you know. In the future, who knows? I think we like being part of the background. We like being connectors and of people, and because I think that there's a huge generation of new talented Vietnamese Americans.
There's a lot of creatives that we've met
that we that we love to promote instead, and we would love to like connect them instead, you know. And and so that's what you see us doing a lot lately, and I think we would rather do that than be the forefront.
And I can attest to that, because I'll tell you what, you're right, what you said in the beginning, where there's a lot of people doing what you do with bigger numbers, but oddly, you could say better, but oddly, those people are not the people that in my circles have referred to you. Like the people in my circles have all said, why haven't you got the Ravenous Couple on? And I was always puzzling to me, why is it that this couple is always being referred to as you need to get them on the show? You know what I mean? As I can attest to several other food people that I know in the space with big numbers. And I think we just have to talk about that. I have to address that right now. Bigger numbers don't mean shit to me. Right.
That's true.
Yeah. What's important? Well, I mean, obviously the signals on the ground for me is like my friends, you know, my important, you know, close friends have said Ravenous Couple over and over and over again. Like, you know, Winbui, you know, he's a private chef up here in LA, and he speaks so highly of you from like day one when I started this. So he's one of the guys, and then, you know, maybe two or three other people in that sort of that range. And then, you know, I started seeing you with Guimai and all of this other stuff. And, you know, we invited you out to our, you know, East Films party. And I began to understand like the fabric of the community is really about that moment. I feel like with that George Floyd awakening, and I didn't know that about you two at all. I didn't know the history background there's this common thread of like making sure that people inside and outside of our world are good, right? Yeah. It's not just about food, or it's not just about our art, but it's about the society that we live in that has to be addressed and acknowledged. And I think that's what gravitated me towards inviting you both to our event and, you know, making friends with you and being acquaintances, more than acquaintances, because the impact that you bring, I can see it like roll out in the future. And I can see where this is heading for the both of you.
So, you know, one of the reasons why we kept the blog going so long is that actually the feedback we got from people was really tremendous. The private feedback through emails and was tremendous. I mean, we would get emails not just all over the world saying, you know, this is exactly how my mom does it, and you know, and I was never able to get the recipe from her, or I was never able to get the recipe from my grandma because she passed, or something like that. We would get like, I would say like so many of those type of emails. And so that's, that was a big influence. And how much, you know, some of these recipes reminded them of their, you know, their youth and them growing up, and brought back so much, you know, great memories. So we had that. But then we also had, I think we made partly because of the timing and for the duration we've been doing it was, you know, during that time, maybe in the early, during that early ages of the internet blogging and things like that, it reached out to certain core people, I guess, because we actually have a lot of chefs, you know, I'm not gonna name who, would say, you know, they will reach out to us and say, you know, you guys were the inspiration for why we started cooking Vietnamese food. And now we're like, now we have restaurants, you know?
So that's really inspiring.
So we actually, I mean, a lot of chefs, a lot of Vietnamese American chefs. And I'll mention someone you know, Daniel. Daniel came back to us. We just met Daniel from some guy.
Oh, he wrote such a nice
some guy. Yeah. And we didn't even know this, but he emailed us, and he's like, you know, it was because of your blog and your recipes that I actually decided to travel to Vietnam.
Yeah, and that was so
and then that's how he started doing, you know. So I was like, what? No way, you know. Yeah. That's unbelievable. So
and now look at him now. He was just over maybe like a month ago, and he did like a tasting with us at our house. So it's just amazing how it all connects.
Yeah.
So we would ever meet him Little did we ever
or
know
blog,
that,
whatever, even
like inspire him to do this.
To like travel to Vietnam and things like that.
So it makes us like so proud.
So that's just one example, I guess.
And not a lot of people are like gonna write notes and you know, message us that. So we just hope to have like a little bit of, you know, influence, not only on food, but just being good, you know, and
just doing good.
Just doing that, good.
Yeah, and that's, we could see it, you know, we could see these things. I think as society, we can see it, you know. You know,
go ahead.
Shout out to Sung Kai. Daniel has been an amazing force in, you know, that guy could be doing anything, actually. That, you know, he could be doing anything. He could be an art history professor. He could be a linguistics professor. He could definitely be a food critic. He is so good at explaining the Vietnamese culture. And for such a young man,
he's such a young talented man. Technical, too.
Technically talented. And just his heart is in the right place. And, you know, I just did an episode with him and Dip Tran over at Good Girl Dinette, author of the Red Boat Cookbook. And it's so fascinating to see the two of them, you know, in dialogue and hear. It's awesome.
Yeah, so, and like I said, those are the people we like to promote from the background. And, you know, same thing with Nguyen, you know, we actually hosted his first pop-up here in our backyard. And we wanted to do that because, you know,
we saw talent and
we also have a stake, so to say, in the Vietnamese food scene in LA. And so we wanted to promote him because we think it could still be improved, you know? Yeah. And so that was one of the reasons behind us sort of trying to push him in and support him. Because we still see LA Vietnamese food as an area that could use improvement. You know. So, and we wanted him to make his own food and make his own Vietnamese food his way, and so, you know, that's our story with Nguyen.
It's so amazing that, he's an interesting character too, because he didn't study food, he didn't go to school for food.
Right. Yeah.
I think it was like neuroscience or something like that. I forget the exact branch there, but he thinks about food in a very different way than chefs typically think. Obviously, he's had the training at Rustic Canyon, but you know, his approach to food is very different. And then I think there's this other service side that we don't get to see, which is like, what do you do when you're having to cook for Elton John, right? Or, you know, these big producers of Hollywood that, you know, I'm not really at liberty to talk about. I guess I am sometimes, but not in public. I because there's probably NDA agreements that he has to do. But he is the top of the food chain when it comes to this private chefing.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Here in LA for Vietnamese chefs.
Yeah, and that's wonderful. We pretty much just told him, just come over and just do whatever you want. And then he made it happen. Yeah, so it was fun.
Yeah, our history of LA Vietnamese food is there needs to be more, but I think it's more of a numbers game, right? There's just much more people in Orange County. And so you're going to get, you know, a lot of people who try and they fail, but the ones that make it at the very end is the best of the best. Yeah. And that's what we see in, you know, in Orange County Vietnamese dining.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bigger, I think, it's not just about being the best, to be honest with you. You know, we see plenty of like, okay, restaurants doing well and surviving in other restaurant niches, right? Like Italian and things like that. I think part of the issue with Vietnamese restaurants in LA in general is that it's tend to be undercapitalized, And these are either passion projects that are undercapitalized to really do well. You know what I mean? I think, and often they're mom and pops for, that don't have the financial backing, you know, that really you need to really do well. You know what I mean?
Let's talk about that. Let's break that down, because that's something that's very rarely talked about. I mean, you could be a good kitchen or a bad kitchen, but if you have that capital, that extra cap, I mean, how do you even know that, Hung? Like, how are you exposed to that part of the business? Like, do you that for you, you know, to bring that up?
You know, because again, I'm no way associated with any restaurants. But I do know a lot of chefs. We do know a lot of chefs, both in the Vietnamese community and, you know, non-Vietnamese community. And we also eat out, you know, quite a bit, and we cook as well. So I think in a way, even though we never own a restaurant or have that type of experience, like, we sort of know what it takes, you know, to really make a restaurant successful. And part of our we love supporting Vietnamese restaurants in general, you know, and so we would love to see a thriving Vietnamese restaurant community. But we don't really see that in LA. And, you know, like a lot of restaurants, like, you know, a lot of Vietnamese restaurants don't have a great success in LA. In Orange County, yes, because the sheer number of Vietnamese people there supporting them. But they tend to be, again, restaurants that are, you know, that charge, you know, a low price for and low wage, and they're very, you know, they're not what you call aspirational restaurants, right? They're sort of like, they're there to just survive and just, you know, make money for the day or for the, you know, for the week. They're not aspirational restaurants, except for, I guess, for the exception of Min and her Porgy and her Fennekite. It's, you know, we would love to see more aspirational restaurants than, you know,
but Fennekite's not even Vietnamese. I mean, so, you don't get Vietnamese aspirational restaurants because of the price points and people the mind of the public. It's like, I'm not paying $30 for an entree, Vietnamese entree, right?
Most of that from Vietnamese people, because they know,
right?
Like,
right,
they already know how much they can get it at so. I feel like the ones that usually complain about the pricing are the Vietnamese people.
Right. That's another huge barrier that, you know, it probably won't die in our generation, but, you know.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about this. Is it because it's the intrinsic value of the raw goods, the raw material, the grain, the meat, the whatever the raw material is going into the restaurant? Is it an intrinsic value in the food ingredients, or is it a marketing, or is it a perspective that the public has that is not placing a higher value on Vietnamese food? Because if you think about pasta, it's just like, how is pasta and Italian food outpriced, you know, compared to Vietnamese food? It's more intricate to make Vietnamese food.
Right. It's definitely the latter. Yeah. It's definitely the latter. And actually, we touched upon this a couple years ago when you know, Tejo Rao did a New York Times article on bánh cuốn, and she came to us, and we as an example of why is Asian American food, or why Vietnamese in this instance Vietnamese food in particular, so undervalued. Why is the skill involved so undervalued, you know? Because she came over to our house, and we made bánh cuốn for her, and then she realized how hard it is and how, you know, to make.
And
then
so
she featured all these bánh cuốn places in Little Saigon. And, you know, her question was, you know, why is this $10 versus, you know, four raviolis is $24, you know? And it's much harder to make. And it's made like a la minute, right, at the moment, fresh for every customer, you know. So where is society placing that value, you know? And frankly, it isn't, right? And part of it is that either people don't know how it's made, and so we need to educate people more. And so that's what we try to do on our blog. Like, you know, this is so
when
we post
takes.
When
this
we post our you know, Instagram story of like Bangkun, we like to show like, okay, this is what it takes, yeah, and how it's done, and
so
people can
valued.
Hopefully people
appreciate
can appreciate
it
and
give more value,
pay more for it.
It,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because and so yeah, I think it's partly society and not placing a good value on Vietnamese food, and because it is, you know, immigrant food, and immigrant food tends to be, you know,
and I think
cheap.
Maybe they look at like the supplies aren't as expensive, like it's just rice flour and so forth, so they're thinking, oh, the supplies aren't expensive, but the labor and the skill that goes into it, not everyone can do it, so
you know what saddens me is to hear Hong say, you know, this is probably not going to change in our lifetime. Wait a minute, we have to deconstruct that, right?
I'm being pessimistic.
Yeah,
you are. Slowly changing.
Yes, yes, but that's a sentiment I think a lot of us feel too. So I don't think it's a exclusive thing that just you feel that way. I think we, as a younger generation of Vietnamese in America, we do feel that way. And let's deconstruct that. Why do you feel that way, and how can we change that? Is it possible to change that viewpoint across the board, not just within the Vietnamese American perspective, but globally, the how can we change that perspective throughout the United States for people to see the value in the labor of the chefs and the cooks that do Vietnamese food? It's not easy. It's very complicated, complicated cooking. More complex.
Well, I have faith. I have faith in the younger, in the current generation of chefs and the younger generation of chefs that you know, that will carry the torch. You know, and you know, and I think. You know, I think just over time, it's just like anything, attention to detail, doing it the best as you can, making the highest quality product. And you can call it whatever you want. You can call it Vietnamese cuisine. You can call it Cali Vietnamese cuisine. You can call it whatever you want. But and try not to label it, to balance with you. And I think over time, if you take that care and you take that excellence and demonstrate that daily and with your food, eventually people will notice, you know. And I think eventually, you know, that's really the only way. Because, you know, I think like for example, if you take Thich Khao, you know, the way we make Thich Khao and present it, you know, you just deconstruct it, you know, what can be improved every step of the way? What can we improve? What can we change? What we can, you know? And so even when we make that our Thich Khao, like, for, you know, maybe a few weeks ago, we made Thich Khao and we added crispy rice to it. And then we presented it at the table and we poured the nuoc leo on it. You know, I don't know, you know, maybe little things like that. You know, it's exactly the same dish, exactly made it the same way, you know, nutritional way, but just present it slightly different, adding different elements to a traditional Vietnamese dish. Can, I don't want to say the term elevate, you know, because I think regular Thich Khao is already great, but it's just
make a difference,
just add value to the experience, I guess. I don't know.
Well, no, those little things do help when you sit down at a nice place,
right?
And you know, you have this these details. They do bring a different feel for the dish that you're eating.
Yeah, just even like with bangkun, you can choose different fillers. There's no or bangmei. Yeah. You could put different fillers in there, and
that make it special. You don't have to pay $5. You can, you know, I you know, you should charge $10 for bangmei. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Have you both been back to Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
What was your experience?
Oh, we loved it. We want to go back as soon as, you know, it gets better. And we'd love to take the kids and have them, you know, see Vietnam and experience it.
Yeah, no, Vietnam is, I think, in some ways, Vietnam is much more creative than here in terms of food, you know. I think the food scene in Vietnam is just amazing. And, And we, when the more we go there, the more we realize how stuck we are here in America, right? Because the food in Vietnam is sometimes so creative and
they have specialties.
It's so varied, you know, from north to south. So in many ways, I think the innovation actually comes from Vietnam, and you know, lots of our innovation here in the U.S. comes from Vietnam.
You know, this idea of stuck in time. Don't get me started. that is a huge issue, I think, in our progress as the Vietnamese American, and it's not because of anybody's fault. It's just when you're separated from a 98 million people, and there's 2 million people on the other side of the world. You know, and it's like, it's not like we are like continentally, you know, joined at land masses where we can just like drive a car or fly, you know, 2 hours to get to our motherland. We are literally separated by, you know, we're separated by financial obligations of flying and cost of plane tickets and lodging. We're separated by, you know, our work that we have to, you know, stay put to do work. We can't just go to the motherland and experiment or experience the culture and then bring it back and then modify what we're living through. And it's shown in music. It's shown in our food. It's shown in our fashion. And what Kim was saying is like, there's so much more creativity. It's again, it's a numbers game of 98 million people being freed now to do whatever the hell they want, to push the boundaries of creativity. Yeah. And I would like to see us integrate more of the cultural sort of growth that's happening in Vietnam. And for, I encourage as many Vietnamese Americans or Vietnamese Europeans or Vietnamese Australians to go back to the motherland as much as possible, so we can all soak in the modern changes. But then there's a lot of young people that are really keeping in touch with the old traditions as well, and they're bringing it back, and all the retro music, the retro the feels of Vietnam's past is also being put on the put on, so for us all to see.
There's
a link that you have on your Instagram, Emmy Mira Ceramics. I was wondering why that was so front and center on your IG post.
Was it 2 years ago now? The time really is really muddled during COVID. We had a fundraiser where, so anyways, the background of Emmy Mira Ceramics is that we do all the ceramics on our plates. The place that you see on our Instagram is all made by
Hawk makes it.
And I make it, but also sometimes my daughter's help, whether it's making a little pinch pot or something like that. So a lot of their dipping sauces that we have on display, like they make it.
The plates.
So we make, So we took some pottery and ceramics and learned. And so last year, 2 years ago, we had a Asian, Stop Asian Hate fundraiser?
Stop Asian Hate.
Fundraiser with the ceramics. So we auctioned off, raised thousands of dollars of our ceramics. So, you know, I wanted to do more of it, but, you know, life's got busy and so I haven't been able to do as much as I wanted to with that. But it's, you know, ceramics is one of those things where it's always there, even if I make a piece, a year later, I haven't finished, I haven't glazed it, I can still do that a year later. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's just sort of sitting in the background, you know, we'll feature it when we want to. But usually what I want to do is like, use that to, you know, promote good, you know, because it is just a hobby for me, and I'm not in any way like a professional ceramicist, you know, but if it's good enough to feature on my plate and my blog, I figure some people might want it.
It's beautiful.
The name?
And the name comes from a combo of our daughter's names.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. The colors, the textures is gorgeous. And I think it's
It
so
makes,
cool. Say it again,
yeah, and
Kim.
it makes the dish look so beautiful, and yeah, so just it's fun.
You guys are so damn humble. It gets me. I mean, it's like I want to hear more of this ceramics. You guys are so humble. I want to hear more of the history of like how did you get inspired by it?
I think a lot of things that Hong gets inspired by is just like when I'm like on maternity leave, like he inspired to make bread because he's gonna be up at like 5 in the morning anyway, because he has to wake up,
Feed
feed the kids. So he's
the
like, oh, I just start making bread so I can feed my starter. And then with
kids.
pottery, I think it was when the
It's one of those things where we went to a fine dining
yeah.
restaurant, the beautiful pottery, and that's often the first thing I check when a dish is given to me.
Yeah,
It's
he'll
like,
look
oh
at the
wow, look at this
bottom.
beautiful
He'll look
pottery.
at the bottom of the plate.
And
Yeah.
then I realized, oh wait, I can actually
Yeah,
take
and
a
he's like,
class and
yeah.
learn to do this.
Yeah.
So that's how it happened.
Yeah.
And again, I'm fortunate enough to have some time to do it and the resources to do it.
Yeah.
So we learned and just then from that point forward, it's sort of like cooking in many ways. It's being doing something creative with your hands, and so
Yeah.
that's why I naturally gravitate towards it.
Yeah. And then just to be able to, like,
And then
I mean,
yeah,
he's not a
just
professional, but being able to like pass it on, and just open our kids' eyes, like, hey, this is like really cool, and they're interested in it and they want to do it as well too. So it makes it, yeah.
Yeah, I want to ask more about it. I'm, because it's not like just white or black pieces. They're like textured color. There's like layers to the coloring, and there's a sort of a design element that you can feel. And when you place food on it, you could see the details, how it all blends in to the vibe that you're presenting. I mean, how much thought in the design process are you putting into it, or is it just sort of like trial and error and you're just going at it willy-nilly?
Well, a lot of ceramics is trial and error. In general, it's a lot of error, more than success with ceramics, because there's so many things that can go wrong in ceramics. So, but in general, if you talk to most ceramicists, they say a lot of the results, consistency is really hard to achieve, and a lot of the results are due to the kiln gods, and if they're good for you that day, then you have a really good batch, and the results will be really good. But you can literally, I've done plates where I did everything the same, glazed it the same way, but and placed it in the kiln, and once it's out, like all four plates will be slightly different. They all have slightly different textures, a slightly different color tone, but they were all done with the same glaze and same technique. And so it's a lot of it is I don't know. Yeah, just the kiln gods and just the natural when you deal with nat products, natural minerals and chemicals and things like that. We don't have that much control, which is another good thing is that nothing has to be perfect.
Yeah.
It's when it comes out,
The
that's how it comes out.
imperfections
The
make it pretty.
imperfections actually make it interesting. Some of my most interesting pieces are the imperfect pieces. And so that's I think that's a great neat thing about ceramics.
It's kind of a metaphor for how the Vietnamese culture in throughout the world has ended up, right? It started out as a very, very imperfect journey leaving the motherland, and today, we have the kiln gods reshaping the way we've landed on our feet, who we turn out to be. I used to
Recent
say
times.
something that I think was really offensive to my mom and dad and the previous generation, because I didn't experience the war the way they did, and I didn't experience the way their previous generation went through, the French, and I always thought, what the heck? We're like living in a th I think I was saying this in my 20s and 30s, but I was like saying, this is like 20 years and 30 years of, living on a vacation, on a, we're exiles in vaca on vacation. But that is something that I experienced was this is such a good life. You know, I had a great life, but obviously there's identity struggles that I went through. But for the most part, you know, it wasn't like crazy. You know, it wasn't as crazy as they went through. But the kiln gods are shaping the way we experience culture. And there's not everybody's going through what I'm going through. And, you know, all of this sort of imperfection in our community is what's so beautiful to record for me, to hear your story and to hear all of the food stories that are coming out and the film stories, the guys that make music and movies. And it is such a beautiful process to see people make their ceramics, quote unquote, you know, and stop for a year. And then 2 more years later, they get back on it and they pop it in. And it's just, there's that process of stop and go and imperfections and all of that. That's really a big journey that our people are going through. And to preserve it and let it grow too and let it breathe is such a beautiful process. What has been the biggest surprise in your journey since you've both started?
Just meeting so many people, right? Meeting so many talents and like meeting you and yeah, just tr meeting, we just never thought we would meet so many amazing, incredible people with so much, you know, talents and that are like-minded as well too. So that has been a really nice surprise. It's just to I probably met more people on Instagram than like right?
I mean, we've been to so many food events, food cultures, met so many amazing people from since we started, either in the industry and not in the industry. It's probably the people, that we've sort of crossed paths, you know,
And the
and all
connections
with the love
and
of cooking, all with the love of Vietnamese food. And that's probably been the best
And
thing
building
we've gained.
friendships,
I mean,
And
the money, again, even though we never really did it for the money, you know, it actually, you know, we did monetize the blog and we get like some income from it still from it. But and so that has never been it, but definitely the people, the connections that we've generated over time. And
that's been really
you know, people
meaningful.
like Daniel emailing us, you know, like, oh, you know, it was 'cause your blog when I read it in 2010 or 11, that's why I read to, went to Vietnam or you know, things like that. And again, and other chefs doing saying similar things. That's why I started cooking Vietnamese food and not French food or whatever anymore. You know, things like that. Like,
I think we are just getting started as a, you know, community of Vietnamese diaspora and in conjunction with the motherland. The stuff that we're all doing, whether it's on the support side like we are, to the people who are actually on the ground creating, we'll start to see in the next few years the rise of the Vietnamese creatives. I really appreciate the work that you've done, and I want to have you both back on to talk about, you know, more developments as we go on through the history of this modern Vietnamese movement.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.